So in this very disturbing time of extremism in some populations against women, has the Buddhist world made any attempts to change its attitude towards women? E.g., only men can attend a monk or drive a monk. It is obviously male-dominated in its upper echelons. Only when women are treated as equal to men will the something have less impact. Please comment if there is time. Well, the rules for the monks are the same for the rules of the nuns. So a woman can attend, or I can offer a meal to a monk, but a man has to be present. And the same with nuns. So say Aya Metanandi, when she is invited to teach in Ottawa, she has to have a female driver. She can't be with a male driver. And vice versa, if we are teaching in Ottawa, we cannot have a female driver. We need to have a male driver. And that rule was set up because three things. Either the monk or the nun lost mindfulness in that intimacy, or the layperson lost mindfulness in that intimacy, or the population at large gossiped. So there are kind of very real incidences of misunderstandings, say, and so on. So then the rules were formulated from those. The rules of the Vinaya were formulated specifically for situations. They weren't an abstract. They didn't kind of, the Buddha didn't say, okay, we're going to do it this way. There are incidences that came up, and the rules came about that way. So I and I have the same kind of rule structures, really. And so that is maybe difficult in Western culture, but I think it does exist. Like, I think sometimes doctors will not do a certain kind of examination to women if a nurse isn't present. And, you know, it exists also in other kind of cultural situations. So there's that. In terms of women's monasticism and men's monasticism, in Taiwan you'll find five times more nuns than monks. And so you'll have a different structure or a different social development of monasticism, Taiwan and China. In Theravada Buddhism, the monastic order died out. We're not sure why, and it's just sort of receiving a revival. So you have a lot of historical things going on there in these societies, and to change them overnight is no, you know, cultural things are very deeply rooted. So to change things takes a long, long time. And so I have limited power and so on to do these things, so I do my best within that. But what you can see is that any institution is unsatisfactory. You know, any family is unsatisfactory, any government system is unsatisfactory. So we kind of do our best in these institutional situations, but that's not, you won't find liberation in that. You won't find liberation in any social construct. And yet social constructs are important for fairness, for safety, you know, for all manner of things. They are important. So some people find, you know, they find it difficult the way Buddhist monasticism works, and I can understand it, but I didn't ordain because of any of those reasons. I just love the Vinaya, and I love the Buddha Dhamma, and then I inherited this tradition, and so I try to kind of do my best within that tradition. So, party's over. Nice sitting with you. I think for me, retreats bring out the best in me. Because there's some aspects of my personality you don't want to know. I'm grateful for the opportunity to get a teaching. If you ever get a chance to teach, go for it. Because it really, if you're going to talk about something, you got to know what you're talking about. And then having talked about it, we come away from it thinking, that wasn't quite on. It was on, but it wasn't quite on. And then you'll ponder, what did I miss there? And you go back into your own practice. I guess it's anything, any kind of craft or whatever. You go back into your own practice and you say, oh yeah, emphasize that too much. What if I emphasize this more? And you'll try again. And you get it wrong again, but better. And then you'll nail it. And then you get a lot of clarity, I think, in teaching. Because you have to be clear in the way you express it. You experiment with words, and it's quite a neat way of learning about yourself. So the kind of suggestions I've been making, these work for me. Right? I don't know if they work for you. And if the hat fits, then wear it. But otherwise, I was emphasizing these two types of meditation, which usually are defined as samatha vipassana. I was just using different language. I'm always sneaking things in. So it's, what is it? Old wine and new flasks? What is it? Sangha? Something like that. So like object-oriented meditation is learning how to settle the mind or stabilize the mind in a peaceful and happy sense as much as you can. And if you think about, I mean, the way I live my life, I have iconography, I have ritual, I have chanting, I have a liturgy, things like that. So all those elements you can see, like I just set up the shrine in my new room. Wow, it's great. Love it. So I got all these pictures of my mom there and Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Chah. There's a massive picture of Ajahn Chah now. And then I have Buddhas that people have given me and mala beads and all manner of bits and candles and incense. So, and I set that up with a lot of heart because it has a lot of meaning for me. Over the years, I have a little Burmese Buddha that Auntie gave me. Auntie was the matriarch of the Wellington scene, Burmese lady, she was a formidable woman. And she gave it to me the year before she died. So it has a lot of meaning for me. So I have this shrine, so every time I go into my room, I bow to the shrine. And just that is established using an object which has emotional content to establish presence. It's a simple kind of activity, but it can be very, very profound. Sometimes I think, how many times have I bowed this lifetime? A million times. And so there's that. I'm just explaining how I use objective reality for stabilizing the mind. So that sounds all very kind of technical, objective reality for stabilizing the mind, but actually it has a lot of heart in it. When I bow to Auntie's Buddha, and there's a lot of good feeling in other Buddhas there. So there's that. There's like the chanting. So we have a liturgy. I guess that's what you call it in the Christian tradition. So like if you take the Metta Sutta, and you memorize it, and then you memorize it, that takes some effort. And I know my early years of monastic life was very, I mean, had a lot of defilements coming up and so on. And I used chanting a lot because we have to learn a lot of chanting. We have one chant which takes about 15 minutes to chant. It's the rules that we do. That took me about 6 months to learn. And it takes a lot of work just to keep it up. Because my memory is sort of, I can pick up stuff fairly quickly, but it's hard to keep it in there. So I would just do memorizing chanting, walking meditation, walking an alms round. And I didn't realize it then so much, but it was a very coarse way to stay centered in the present moment, object meditation. And of course it was nice that then I was an integral part of the Sangha because I knew my lines, as it were. So if you take like the Metta Sutta and you actually memorize it, We don't do much memory work anymore in our culture because we've got Google. You just don't, do you? You don't even need, we don't have a dictionary anymore. Well, what is it, Google? And it goes in one ear. So I was looking up kudos yesterday. Kudos, what are kudos? It's Greek for praise. Right? I hope I remember. Next year I'll forgetting it. Well, memory. So we do a lot of memory work to learn our chanting. But if you take, and a lot of you have memorized the metta chant, this is what should be done. But then what happens, it's interesting with memory, you go through that work, you memorize it, and that, you know, keeps the mind centered. And then after a while it becomes automatic. And then if you don't get it in context, you forget it. You know, one triggers the other, triggers the other, triggers the other. So then you learn how to do it slowly. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. And do that real slow. And then each phrase is it's profound contemplation, really, because there are some very meaningful phrases in that. So that's taking an object and stabilizing mind with that object. But it has a lot of intentionality in it, very wholesome. So at the end, you recite that kind of carefully. And then you take your posture, and that's an object. And you stabilize your attention into the posture. You learn how to hold your body on a chair or sitting on the floor. So that stabilizes the mind at present moment. But at no time are you just kind of zeroed in on the object that you don't know what's going on. You know, and I think that kind of zero in on the object too strictly, I don't think that really works. It's not like it's not a harsh, forceful, controlled kind of attention. It has a much more open and peaceful and relaxed quality, I suppose. So then your object meditation is your body, and you learn a lot. You learn that your body is a fantastic indicator of energy, of resistance and anticipation, where you're at right now. It has emotional content, and the body's fantastic feedback mechanism. The body doesn't lie. The mind is always lying. So you learn just, you know, through awareness practice. Oh, what's the body saying right now? And as you're meditating, you're always referring to the body, not by thinking about it, just you're noticing the body. Oh, the body's getting tight. Oh, he's falling asleep. Oh, it's really relaxed now. Oh, yeah, okay. So the body is an object which indicates the way things are. And you, like, I think in meditation, you really have to learn if you're sitting practice, you have to learn how to keep the spine strong as much as you can. So if you're on a chair, you try to get your hara out, and at least that's what I do, and get the posture tall and the shoulders open. And if your meditation is proceeding well, that happens quite naturally. Then if you're doing lying meditation, you have to learn how to not to go into the porridge of the mind. It's very, very difficult, actually, lying meditation, or not getting all, you know, in the quagmire of thought and dullness. So then, okay, how can I use not moving as an object of meditation? So it's all, you know, this is all kind of what we call samatha practice. But within it, there's also insight going on. You're understanding, you know, when I make this kind of effort, I get this result. When there's this kind of hindrance, I can do this. Oh, yeah. So, like I always say, my biorhythms are such that usually at around 10, and if I'm doing a retreat at 10 in the morning, I get just a touch of sleepiness. I do sufficient amounts of coffee that it's not it's not significant, but I just know that at that time of day, for some reason, the mind-body wants to do that. If I have not had enough sleep, then it can happen any time. So then I just know, oh yeah, that's what's going to happen. Been there a million times. And then, okay, then I just do a lot of pulling up the spine for maybe half an hour. This is what I'm going to do. So it's kind of a yoga exercise. And that's what I've learned about my body. So you set up the body, and then you intentionally pick up the object to meditate, or you establish mindfulness like I like to, sound body, and this is in awareness. You get a feeling for awareness not being dependent on object. That's why I talk about that. It works for me. So listen, feel, listen, feel, listen, feel. You go back and forth, toggle between it, and say, ah, yeah, okay. And you get a sense of what awareness is. So then you've got, then you're on the path. Yeah, you're on the path. And then, so how can you stay on the path now for the next 45 minutes? And then you might choose an object, you might just do that. I'll just do balance, balanced attention. Oops. And then, okay, the hindrance of dullness has arisen. Okay, what do I need to do? So then you start to apply effort because you know what balance is. So you're not trying to get, if you establish balance first, then all your efforts are just to return to something you already know. If you think that you have to acquire something in the future, then you don't really quite know what you're trying to acquire. And it'll never be what you thought. And so acquisitions don't work. Whereas the awake mind, at least from my experience, the awake mind is always available. So that's why I use the word available. Because if you're available, then you're mindful. So it's available plus you are available. And then, and that's what we talk about right understanding in Buddhism. Right understanding, the Noble Eightfold Path is method. So right understanding is not conclusion. It might be at some final point, but it's method. Right understanding is method. It's the path. As opposed to usually we think like right understanding is you acquire a piece of information and then you're, oh, that's it, I've got it, I know now. Turn the page to the next encyclopedic piece of information. So I know what kudos is, right? So I've got right understanding. I'll move on to my next word. But that's, in Buddhism, right understanding is like, it's again, it has a dynamic and reflective sense to it. So for me, right understanding is knowing what awareness is. Oh, this is awareness. This is right understanding. I understand this moment now. I'm present to this moment. This moment is this way now. Refuge, Buddha knowing Dharma, non-attachment, non-clinging, watchful, available. It's all pointing for me, to the same thing. So that's right understanding. And it's not a thought. It's this way now. okay, that's right understanding. I understand the moment. And then a wrong understanding would be preoccupation. Or usually we say that's attachment or clinging or grasping, these different words. So I've been trying to use this different word, non-preoccupation or preoccupation. So then preoccupation is dullness, that's a preoccupation. Fantasy, resentment, whatever, doubt. You know? And it's just, I'm just preoccupied with thought, feeling, the five khandhas. And then awareness is, oh yeah, pain is this way. Planning. You just keep coming back. So you're always returning home, until home becomes much more attractive than objects. Much more interesting, actually. And what is that? What is that awareness? And you just kind of abide, you just learned how to hold it and be with it. And then in that kind of watchful, available attitude, shall we say, or awareness, that begins to also open up more subtle insights. Because the more subtle insights into like duality and self and attachment, those kinds of things, and there are subtle levels of that, I think, that can't take place if I'm preoccupied. I can never see anything new if I'm preoccupied with the old, can I? There's no space. Just the mind's kind of lock-jammed with whatever. So even like we were talking about fear last night, isn't it? I can be with fear but not preoccupied by fear. I can be aware of fear. So it's like not being preoccupied doesn't mean there is no feeling. There is feeling and there's pain and there's pleasure and the whole business is going on, but it's known as anicca dukkha anatta. And hence the method of Buddhist vipassana practice, then, if we use that word, it's a fraught word sometimes in Buddhism, but is the method is seeing characteristics. So we call that characteristic meditation. The characteristic of bodily feelings is they rise and cease. Characteristic of thoughts, they rise and cease. Characteristic of memory, that rises and ceases. And it's not personal. It's dependently originated. It depends. Mm-hmm. And so characteristic meditation is abiding as that kind of witness of change. Ajahn Chah's, it's uncertain, it's uncertain, it's uncertain. So that's also method rather than position. You can certainly take the position that all conditioned phenomena are, if they're born, they must die. That's the position. So in a Buddhist funeral in Thailand, the monk will often say, brothers and sisters in old age, sickness and death. And we are, you know, we're one in this kind of human paradox. But if you just leave it as a position, as I said the other night, then you know all you have is a Buddhist opinion, and it's not wrong opinion, but you don't have the kind of dynamic, insightful quality of what we call wisdom. So panya, wisdom, is the application of that method. So when I can say, let's say I'm annoyed at someone in the monastery for being whatever. And the annoyance comes up, and I say, uncertain. Now, let's say I've made a judgment about someone. Let's say someone new comes in the monastery, and they're having difficulty, and I make a judgment about their character. And then I say, uncertain. And that puts me in a place where I could still be with that judgment, but I can know that's just a condition that has arisen. And then I remain open to that person, don't I? And then I say, oh, my judgment seems pretty accurate. Okay, this is the way I can help them or whatever. But often it's not true. More often than not, I'm not a good judge of people, actually. So then I ask, Chunda, what do you think? And I need to, you know, we have people come and they want to be an anagarika, or they want to be, what do you think? You know, so it's a part of my job description, I suppose. So these two ways of meditation, object meditation, and then noticing characteristic lakkhana. So it's called aramana meditation or lakkhana meditation is a kind of Pali word. I sort of been trying to allude to that in non-traditional words, because sometimes when you hear a word, like you hear samatha vipassana, you've already got a whole, if you've got a Buddhist background, you have a whole kind of set of definitions, which then you think you know what the person's talking about, and then you don't listen anymore. Well, he said vipassana, okay, I know what that means. So language is, I find, a kind of interesting challenge. So the capacity then to sustain watchful, available attitude then allows for insight to arise. You know, allows seeing things as changing allows for insight to arise. And then I think that the more refined insights around what we call emptiness, around, you know, not self and so on, they become apparent through just waiting for nothing. So that's a sort of summation of how, you know, you might approach the practice. Don't dismiss object meditation. Try to find, like Susan's, you know, found something which is helpful to you and makes the heart happy. Great. Honor that and cultivate that. And if it's not Buddhist, that's fine. So I was telling Jane, I have a friend in New Zealand who used to be a potter. Jane's a potter, of course. And this lady, she's too old now, but she did pots. She's a potter. And she also did dervish turning. I mean, talk about turning. So I went to a... They have a... In Wellington, they have a dervish turning group that's also connected to Advaita Vedanta. So we went... And they like people to witness the turning. So I went there, and it was really neat. They're kind of... I think there were six people in the circle, and then there was the kind of, I don't know what they call them, there's a Muslim word, or a Persian word for it. Anyway, they're kind of turning around, six people, the dervishes, but there's this the center person, I forget. There's one main person, right? So kind of. Anyway, so they've got these lovely skirts, and I asked them, how do they do, how come you don't get dizzy? I said, they focus on a thumb. So then I was there with another monk, and he tried it in his kuti, and I heard him ramming into his wall.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of very centering kind of practice. So, and you know, all there's so many religious traditions have developed object meditation, right? But also, you'll get, whether it's, you know, Sufism or Advaita Vedanta or Thomas Merton, or you get also transcendent insights, won't you? So, like, say, if you read Thomas Merton's Asian Journal, he had a huge insight into kind of Buddhist ideas of transcendence. Just very, very, it's a real shame he died so young. He goes to Polonnaruwa, which is a famous ancient site in Sri Lanka, and he has this epiphany of emptiness in couched in very Buddhist terms. And I could never understand his Christianity, but I always felt he had something, even though I didn't understand it. So sometimes the language of transcendence is very different. They're cultural, it's phrased in different ways, and we can't quite understand it. So my vocabulary of transcendence is not theological, not theosophical. I was at the Theosophical Society in Chicago this year, but theological. In other words, God is not a word that works for me. But when I, you know, read, like, say, Karen Armstrong's History of God, and it's fascinating how, like, some of the Judaic interpretations of God or the mystic Christian were very close to Advaita Vedanta, which are very close to the ideas of how Nibbana is expressed. So the language of transcendence, because it's trying to point to something which isn't an object, is a very, very difficult language, and it's quite often cultural. So Buddhism, say, doesn't tend to talk about the transcendent so much, because then we objectify it, and then we try to find it as an object. So Buddhism's approach to that is the letting go of attachment to objects. That's its basic strategy. And that which keeps us infatuated with objects is craving for pleasure, craving to get rid of pain. So it's not making a statement against pleasure and pain, it's just saying that magnetic attraction of the sense realm of thoughts and emotions and bodily things, that very attraction makes you unavailable to the transcendent. So letting go or non-grasping is just trying to set up the conditions to realize the unconditioned. And that you cannot do that with craving, because craving itself, say by the Pali definitions, craving always involves craving for an object. So, like, I have a yearning for transcendent. You know, I read Lompa Liam, I said, wow, this is possible at some deep, deep level. And that yearning is okay. I mean, that's really wholesome. But if I mistake that yearning, and then if that yearning gets convoluted into I have to get something, the Buddha's saying, no, it's not a thing, it's not an experience in the usual way of a sense experience. It's the letting go of attachment to the khandhas. Hence we talk about the khandhas, letting go, non-attachment, letting go of craving. So that's a kind of huge, huge piece in Buddhism. You have to kind of get your head around it. But if you do get your head around it, then it becomes very obvious. It can't be in the khandhas. So that, just like when I just say, I use the word can't be in the khandhas. If you don't understand what khandhas means and all of that, if you don't have that background, then I have to lay it out more for you. So Buddhism has a kind of short form language, like science has short form languages and so on. So it's not. So when Buddhism says that, like in that morning chanting, it's pretty grim, isn't it? It's all about suffering and. Yeah. Give me breakfast, will you? But what it's pointing to is that the conditions are bound by birth and death, right? But the unconditioned, and so it's just saying don't look in the wrong place. So if you have a sense of that in Buddhist ideas, then you know how to use the objective world to live in it well as best you can, to live socially responsible and so on, and then use objects for meditation, but then that kind of curiosity about the transcendent, that to me seems, and that's really why the Buddha taught. He never taught a social philosophy. You know, Buddhism doesn't answer all questions. Those we have to figure out. He didn't talk about some of the social issues we have now. We have to figure those out ourselves. But he was pointing to one thing, suffering and the end of suffering, in the way that he had realized it. So it's not a teaching which it actually covers very little, you know, in terms of governmental institutions or hygiene. Or Rudolf Steiner had a lot more than the Buddha did in terms of, you know, in those things. So it's just a little bit. It's just about suffering and the end of suffering. But I think it's a pretty important bit for us.